Welcome to A Global Focus with Daryl Sims, the Alien Hunter. Daryl Sims, an international researcher, is a certified master hypnotherapist, master NLP practitioner, and board-certified hypnotic anesthesiologist. Daryl Sims has authored with Patricia Gray two books on the alien implant topic. First, The Alien Hunter, The Evidence and Light, and the second book, Alien Hunter, Evidence and Truth About Alien Implants. Welcome, everyone. Tree Sheridan speaking, host of A Global Focus. Daryl Sims is tonight's program guest. A Global Focus airs live on the International Paranormal Radio Network with its anchor station, UPRN, 105.7 FM New Orleans. Other listening venues include U.S. Stream TV, Live 365, Awcast, and Shoutcast, and mobile phone by dialing 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. Thank you to Joe Montaldo, owner of the Paranormal Radio Network, for making these broadcasts possible. This week's program features Daryl Sims, the Alien Hunter, a top international researcher and authority in the UFO ET field. Daryl Sims' specialties include certified master hypnotherapist, master NLP practitioner, and board-certified hypnotic anesthesiologist. Daryl's achievements have resulted in worldwide recognition with numerous awards of his expertise in the investigative, ufological, and extraterrestrial fields. Additional career accomplishments include Daryl Sims' past service as a police officer and as a training instructor for the CIA. Daryl Sims' media credits include appearances as a topic expert on the Learning and the Discovery Channels, the program Sightings, the Colbert Report, the History Channel, and the Sci-Fi Channel. Daryl, his team, and their organization, Saber Enterprises, offer their consultative and support services to experiencers and researchers free of charge. Daryl and the Saber team focus on evidence and data consistency with all investigations, while appreciating the specific details and examination aspects of each case. The Saber team has achieved important findings from their study of the infrared, ultraviolet, and other light manifestations related to the UFO phenomenon. Saber also has developed the scientific protocol required for successful retrieval of DNA samples at reported extraterrestrial appearance sites. Two books detail the research findings of Daryl and team. The first book, Alien Hunter, The Evidence and Light by Daryl Sims with Patricia Gray, presents a compilation and analysis of research results. The second book, Alien Hunter, Evidence and Truth About Alien Implants by Daryl Sims with co-author Patricia Gray, details the latest research findings on alien implants and recent case developments. Daryl Sims' website can be found at www.alienhunter.org. Good evening, Daryl. Welcome to the show.
Good evening, young lady.
Thank you, sir. I like that comment. Daryl, the audience and I look forward to hearing of your research projects and developments. Also, your two books on implants contain a vast amount of useful information on that subject and of great significance. You join us after presenting at Roswell this past weekend.
Yes, we had an incredible time at Roswell. I did eight presentations, four in the early afternoon, and I did four that were more advanced in the later afternoon. And they dealt with everything from literally from the implant phenomena, physical evidence, forensics, some DNA work that we've done and accomplished some things in, and last but not least, dealt with, I gave a class that was just packed on the difference between ghosts, aliens, demons, and angels, and that they all had a different signature each, and it was easy to define them based on that information, and it went over very well.
Yes, your presentations as well as your book contain very useful information, very important information, and you definitely are one of the stars at Roswell every year. Now, Daryl, your Saber team is composed of dedicated staff, researchers, and professionals covering many scientific disciplines and research aspects. Now, your research is carried on domestically and globally. I read an email, though, recently, which notes the unique nature of your research. And that email is from a John Edmonds, MSW, who references a Sims technique as to obtaining the true intent of an individual after that person's actual motivations and experiences are perceived through piercing the screen memory. With this Sims technique, can an outside agency or force or party acting upon an individual be detected? Please give us details on this. It was an interesting email there from John Edmonds, MSW.
Well, what he's actually referencing is the fact that when people are taken in these events, whether they come back an abductee or a contactee, which to me is you come back a honeybee or a killer bee, one of the two, based on how you decide to interpret that experience. But the bottom line is that these entities leave with everyone in 99% of these cases, they leave what is called a screen memory. That is often a nonsensical aspect or a nonsensical so-called memory of what happened to you. In other words, you may have been taken and put on the slab and different things done to you, and then when you come back, you suddenly don't remember that. You feel like you were in the school of higher consciousness or something like that. And the problem is that many people who deal with this phenomena who are taking an honest and a decent approach toward it, often make mistakes, in my opinion, when they decide to hypnotize these people. Sometimes they hypnotize the screensaver memory rather than the actual memory itself. And simply put, we call it the difference between memory and recall.
Boy, that's interesting, and I would very much appreciate, Daryl, your giving some explanation as to the difference between the terms screen memory, screen saver, and screen dreams. Now, I know you'd agree with me that all of them are violative, and I have to just give a plug here to ICAR. I think ICAR were the discoverers of the screen memory concept. You have given an excellent further definition of the screen memory, screen saver, and screen dreams. Now, could you just describe somewhat the different types and how they're aspects that an individual is an experiencer?
Well, certainly. The actual history of the screen memory comes from Freud himself, but mm-hmm. it's been applied to the UFO field most correctly, I think, by ICAR and others.
Yes.
And very well so. But basically what that means is that people receive a bogus memory. And a good example of that is when you go to a stage show and you're up there and they're having you act like Elvis Presley or some other individual that you're obviously not, and you actually believe that you are. And when you come out of there, you realize, oh, I couldn't have said that. I couldn't have done that. And you're shocked to see the film. That's a screen memory, so to speak. That is in effect, it's the true false memory syndrome that the alien has installed in most of us who have been through these experiences, myself included. The bottom line is that if a hypnotist, as an example, hypnotizes the screen memory, in other words, he doesn't know the difference between the two, between what the real memory of what happened and the screen memory which the alien is left with him, then he is just as liable to hypnotize the screen memory. That will activate what is called, which I've called in my book, a screen dream. A screen dream is a nonsensical compilation and continuation of the screen memory which never existed to begin with. And they will go on with this and ramble on with the story, and the hypnotist will literally verify it for them if they don't know the difference between the two.
That's an excellent explanation. Thank you, Daryl. And, you know, I heartily approve of your comments as to the definite existence of a syndrome, the post-traumatic abductee syndrome. Do I have that correctly phrased?
Yes, post-traumatic stress syndrome is a common aspect of what happens
right.
to abductees. Mm-hmm. Many of them simply don't know what's happened to them, and they're traumatized from the event, and they don't even know why. And most of them will actually try to debunk their own event and try to say, well, this couldn't be true. This is impossible. it couldn't be true and so on. And yet whenever we pull out the equipment, if we get to them in time within a 24-hour period, we can often find fluorescence on them and other physical evidence, markings and so on, that their events were in fact real.
Boy, that's excellent. And, you know, I misspoke there. I should have termed it the post-traumatic abduction syndrome, which particularly relates to the abduction experience, but, of course, has its parallels with the post-traumatic syndrome of other type of experiencers or victims, such as wartime or other very powerful events. Now, you know, Daryl, I have a quick question here, because then I want to get right back to your excellent work. ICAR has a particular term, downloads. Has SABR found any indications of downloads being received from experiencers?
To make sure I have your question right, you mean a download, in other words, from the entities themselves to the abductee?
Yes, thank you. I should clarify that. Yes, of information, yes.
Yes, they're a bit, and sometimes this gets me in a bit of trouble, but I usually tell people that that about 80% of the so-called abduction contacts that happen are mm-hmm. just that. They're contacts. They're not actual abductions. Most of the time, the entity will do whatever it is that they're going to do with the abductee where they're at. They won't take them anywhere. In other words, it may be in your bedroom. It may be mm-hmm. in a sleep state. It may be while you're driving down the road or whatever. But that's where the event will actually occur. And the abduction, with the exception of about 20% of the time, 80% of the time there will be no physical abduction, but a download of information or an upload of information will often occur during that time.
Thank you. That's very intriguing information, Daryl. Appreciated. Now, Daryl, am I correct that your last encounter as to personal alien abduction was at age 17, but you note the war with your alien abductors began at 3.5? Further details on that.
Certainly. My events, you have to understand, and I'm going to date myself here a little bit and bring some bit of humor. My events started in 1952. That is an example. There weren't really any alien movies or anything back then. Nobody knew what an alien was or anything else. And here I am in bed looking at this creature that's walking away from me, and little did I know at the time that he had actually brought me back. My event is over, and he's walking toward the wall, and I can't figure out, number one, what he is, because he's tall, long, spindly, and pure white, and there's a small amount of light in my room from an outdoor light. It's in the wintertime, and at 1005 South K Street in Midland, Texas, 1952, in a little frame home, and I'm thinking, you know, I can't figure out why he's walking toward the wall, and I keep thinking, what is that? And he turns around, he hears me thinking, which is interesting, fascinating, and he realizes as he looks at me that he's made a mistake. In other words, I'm going to remember. So now he's got to figure out how to put a screen memory in me, a false memory, that will make me think I've had a bad dream and thus deny my own event and so on. Long story short is he moves toward me, and I wasn't paralyzed, wasn't afraid, wasn't anything at this time. And at that moment, he transferred, because I know this from over 1,000 cases now worldwide, he transferred to me his fear. And that just literally paralyzed me. I've never known anything like that in my entire little four-year life. And he was coming toward me, and I was most frightened. I pushed so hard against my little tiny bed that it was a little like army cot, and it pushed apart from the wall, and then I fell and hit my head on the floor, and now the worst nightmare any child can even begin to imagine occurred. He couldn't get to me that way, so he lifted up the covers under the bed and stuck his large bulbous head with those large black eyes, which were perfectly round, not elliptical like the Hollywood version. And he looked, got very close to my face, and tried to change his image of himself in my mind to that of a clown, so that I would think I had had a bad clown dream and that he was not real. And I kept shaking my little head, no, 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 because I wanted to remember him for what he was and not for what he wanted me to think he was.
It's very intriguing information. And, you know, I also in your readings was impressed by your comment of how important it is for the experiencer to overcome that aspect of fear, or at least as much as possible. And the fact, that, too, that you're an admirer of the Frank Herbert Dune series, one of my very, very favorites. Now, a very quick question here. Daryl, you note in your work that you have seen several entities. And before that, I just want to note something here for the audience. Daryl has become the alien hunter, the nemesis of those who seek to intrude upon the lives of many. And I just have to note here that his courage and willing assistance, that of Daryl and team, are known throughout the field. Thank you, Daryl. I've got a question in the audience from Alien Talk Erica. I believe she has a very exciting program there on the net, and I think on radio as well. Question for Daryl, how can you decipher what is screen and what is real memory?
A very great question. Absolutely great question. A brilliant audience. I just love this. To begin with, generally, I'm going to answer this in an obvious way, and then I'm going to get more specific, which is, I'm sure the person asking the question would like for me to do. But for the rest of the audience, for part of the audience that may not be familiar with this, many people will have a screen memory of a large owl or a large wolf. In other words, they may have gone camping and they had a strange dream of this large wolf or this 3-foot owl or a wounded owl walking on the street in the middle of the night, usually three o'clock in the morning is the dinner bell, so to speak. But these animals are large deer or elk or different things. They have large black eyes, and that's kind of a telltale sign in most of these events. So it's a nonsensical thing. In my case, I had this. He tried to make me think that he was a clown, and it was a terrifying event. And many abductees have clown phobias, and they don't know why. Well, I'm giving you a big hint. The fact is, there is no clown. It was the clown that was there was actually the alien himself, and had nothing to do with a real clown scaring you. The second thing, to tell between a screen memory and versus a real event, is that a lot of that can best be examined in the hands of a good therapist or hypnotherapist who knows what they're doing concerning this phenomenon. For instance, one of the things that we will do will check people for date, time, and in other words, when I'm working with them, I'll ask them, you know, what was the weather like that night, and so on. And I'll go back and check most of these events. For instance, like if your first event was like mine, when I was 4 years old, you know, it was wintertime, and I described the weather and everything else. Usually these people can even describe the exact day and everything. If that's true, it's easy for us to go back and check the weather reports and everything else. These are things that you're not going to be able to make up. I mean, you're just not going to be able to pull out of the air certain aspects of what's happened in history and that sort of thing, and with a person early in their life. Most people just don't remember every detail like that. They just don't. So part of the thing of finding out what is a true screen and what is not is to work with a person in their memory, in the pure memory, over and over and over and over and over, and then pop them into the event. And what will happen is it will bypass if you do this properly, it will bypass the screen memory, as opposed to, so to speak, say, well, tell me what you think happened to you, and so on. And then they say, well, there was this large wolf that was talking to me in my dream, and so on. And now they're going to start going off into the screen memory. And it's pretty obvious in many cases, I think to most people, that probably wasn't a large wolf or a wounded owl 3 foot tall or three little children with large black eyes discussing things with you at 3 o'clock in the morning. Probably those are not true events. So those are just markers to let us know that we need to go past that and find out what actually happened in the event. I can give you a much more technical answer if that comes up again, and certainly will for even a medical, for a nurse that had this situation, and she and her hypnotist couldn't get past the block that was there. Sometimes there will also be, not besides the screen memory, there'll be a block. When a block occurs in a person's memory, in most cases, you saw something you should not have seen or they didn't want you to see or remember. And as a result, they install these blocks even in your screen memories. So that if a hypnotist hypnotizes your screen memory and you run into a block, he's sure he's got memory because there's a block there. And in fact, the block is nothing but a ruse. It's we've seen as many as three different layers of screen memories in certain people.
That's fascinating, Daryl. Now, you know, you just referenced this nurse. Would that be the surgical nurse that was so critical? She works in the West Coast with helping a doctor there deal with a patient who actually, at that time, was pregnant with what might have been a partially alien child. And it sounded like an interesting example. And this nurse, surgical nurse, was really critical in trying to coordinate information between your team and the doctor who was dealing with this patient.
Well, that was a different case, but either one of them proved very, very fascinating for our discussion here tonight. In this case, it was a surgical nurse called me in Houston and said, you need to get out here to California immediately. And I said, okay, what's the deal? And they told me that what was going on in the hospital, so I got out there and I got in touch with the doctor involved and explained to him that who I was and that I would prefer this not become a UFO case, so to speak, that it would stay in the medical field, and that I had a trained psychiatrist and psychologist who would be interested in coming in and working with the patient that he had, who came in with the claim that they had been artificially inseminated or impregnated or raped by an alien. And he told me he didn't believe their story and so on. I said, I if you don't mind me saying so, doctor, I don't agree with you. I think that you do believe the story, and that's the reason you put the individual in the psych ward. He said, we put them in the psych ward because they're crazy. And I said, pardon my being so blunt here, but the evidence I have suggests that that is, in fact, not the case, and you know it. And he said, what do you mean? What do you mean? So he really held my feet to the fire. So at that point, I let him have it, and I told him, I said, well, these markings were on the individual who claimed the sexual assault. And he was just floored. He said, well, how do you know that? How can you know that? I mean, I said, well, this is not the first case I've seen like this. And I said, if you don't handle the case properly, you're going to be probably in the Los Angeles Times as the alien, the doctor who stole the alien baby. He said, what do you mean? I said, because they'll come and get that fetus probably within the first trimester. And you're going to have her in the hospital during this time. And he said, you tell him to convince me. I said, let me go a little further. I said, the reason you've got her in the psych ward is because you don't want anybody to know that the fetus is growing at a rate of 10 to 1. Well, needless to say, he was absolutely shocked. And he got scared then. He says, how do you know all this stuff? I said, this is not my first rodeo. And I said, you have to understand that I'm trying to do everything I can to keep this in the psychiatric department in their hands as much as possible and keep you out of the mix. I said, this will ruin your career if it gets out, because if that fetus disappears, and it will, it is highly likely she's going to accuse you, although you're not guilty of anything. And I said, I'm doing everything I can to save your reputation and keep this not a UFO story per se. In other words, I don't want to be involved. I want our medical people to be involved, but I don't think we need to interject the alien, quote-unquote, UFO aspect of this at this point. It's too many lives are going to be affected, and we don't need her in front page of the paper, and nor you. We just need the evidence. And anyway, he went along and agreed with that. But in another case where a nurse came to my aid, came to my help, asked for my help, in another city some time ago, she had been sexually assaulted and had a long bendable needle inserted in her abdomen. And she started waking up at the wrong time, and they pulled the needle out, and semen squirted all over, and she thought her husband had done that. they had had an agreement that they weren't going to have sex during this time until she quit her nursing career, and then she was going to have kids and settle down and everything. And long story short, she divorced her husband over this. And I said, why would you divorce your husband? She said, because I got pregnant. And, of course, she doesn't understand anything about the UFO phenomenon. She does not know about sexual incubation, basically, what some of these entities do. And she thought her husband had done this, and still to this day thought the same thing. And I said, so what happened? And she said, well, I had a son. What do you think? And I thought, oh, my gosh. And now some people in the audience are probably going to say, well, what she had was an alien child. Well, I don't believe that's the case at all. I think if we do DNA testing on this, and she and the son are both agreed to it, that what we're going to find is that the father is not the daddy, which that's not going to surprise anybody, but we're also going to find that she's not the mommy, that in fact she is nothing more than an incubator for some of these people, like who get their eggs and sperm stolen, and she may be the incubator for that.
Boy, is that thought-provoking. And, you know, Daryl, on that question of abduction sites and non-experiencers, any comments on that or details?
Well, certainly. The first line of evidence that we have been collecting for some time, we got about 15, 16 samples so far of fluorescence that shows on abductees. Now, these are people who've been taken in their events, and they've been physically touched, and it leaves a physical trace on them, like alien sweat, or an alien fingerprint, as some people like to refer to it. And it penetrates the skin on contact, and it, depending on what the alien does to you, whether physical contact, by casual contact, in other words, him grabbing you or holding you or whatever, that's one way fluorescence can get on you. A second way fluorescence can get on you is if they do something procedural. And by that I mean such as in one lady, they left a mandible set on her inside of her arm in fluorescence. So that's the second case. The best case, I think, that we can mention to your audience tonight is that one of our abductees got tired. He had read some material that I'd written some time ago, and I had not met him prior to this, and he read some of my information on self-defense and so on, and so he kind of took it on his own to do just that, knowing they would make mistakes and that they might one day come in and do their job on him and forget to tell him he's paralyzed or whatever. And as a result, that happened one night. He pulled out a Japanese sword laying next to his bed and hit the entity and cut a piece off of it. And, of course, I got the DNA. And now that's it's been most interesting so far because the DNA shows a total connection, according to one scientist, between 37 years of cattle mutilations. No one's ever been able to prove the alien was in it, was involved in it. Everybody knows he is. Everybody knows that they're involved, and they know some of the intelligence community people are involved, but no one's been able to prove conclusively that the alien was involved. And at this point, the DNA suggests alien DNA and cattle mutilation evidence as well, all in the same sample. So this is considered by at least one scientist and one university group to be literally the smoking gun.
Boy, that's fascinating. And I've got another great question here in the discussion room at the Paranormal Radio Network. But just before the question, I wanted to ask. Your research and writings do indicate a tremendous alien interest in human DNA. Daryl, do you think they're seeking to alter, are the aliens seeking to alter the human genome? Also, could we sort of dovetail this question in with a particular alien interest in the warrior traits found in such groups as the Irish and the Native Americans?
Brilliant questions. I love that. I just love these questions. They do have an interest in altering our DNA. We do not know to what end yet. We honestly don't know that. We would be guessing, saying that we knew, because we don't know. But I'm just, this is just the way I am. I mean, I can sit here and bloviate about all kinds of stuff and say it's this, it's thus, and so on, but that doesn't make it true at all. So I'm doing my best to be as honest as possible with my with the audience here. But the bottom line is that they do have an interest in the, as I said, contactees, or in other words, those who come back from the events and feel like their event, they've been blessed or chosen or special or unique or, you know, whatever the alien did was fine to them, so to speak. They come out a contactee, or what I refer to as a honeybee. A honeybee is an interesting metaphor for me, because the honeybee doesn't realize that the little guy there in the funny little white suit, he's stealing your honey. And the honeybee, if you steal the honey often enough, the honeybees get used to the little guy in the funny suit and actually think he's supposed to be there, stealing their honey. However, the abductee, or the Native American Indian Irish Celtic, as an example, when you steal their honey, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. You see, they messed with me for 13 years, and I could live with it, and did. But one day they made a huge mistake, and they came back and got my little boy. When that happened, I declared war. I mean, that was it for me. Kidnapping my children, that's not part of the game anymore. I mean, you're no longer whatever you think you are anymore. You're hunted by me, and I am a licensed private investigator in the state of Texas, and I'm on bounty hunting my second case in the second month on another individual, and they're no different to me than the people I bounty hunt. They've committed crimes, and they're going down for it. So the bottom line to me is that the killer bee, or that aspect of the abductees, the ones who won't knuckle under, who won't bend, who won't agree to this this treatment and the program that they're running, as a result, these type people are the type people you really don't want to, in my opinion, the alien has got a problem. And I think they would like to turn all the honeybees, and all of the killer bees into honeybees if they could. I don't think they're here breeding into us the higher qualities of the universe. I think they're here more interested in breeding things out of us, not into us.
Very intriguing information, Daryl. Thank you. Now, here's that question in the chat text, another excellent one from Alien Talk Erica. Again, she has a great program here on the UFO subject. Her question is, Daryl, do you consider all ETs to be harmful or hostile? And here I'd like to just add my question, too, to dovetail it in with my question. Are there aliens who might be considered neutral or fifth column?
Well, the great questions, and gosh, I love smart people. Gosh, oh, this is great. First of all, I don't think that ETs are ETs. And let me clarify this, and I'm going to throw out some statements that are probably going to raise a whole heck of a lot of questions here in the near future. We've come to a level of our research based on, again, DNA, and other evidence that we found, and the alien, quote-unquote, that we've been looking at, these seven different models, which are nothing more than seven different types of transgenics with Earth, let me say this carefully, Earth DNA that has been modified into a transgenic for the purpose of interaction with human beings, ostensibly calling themselves alien. And the fact is, they're not. They're from here as much as you are. They're just modified entities for that specific purpose. And I'll give you a couple examples and then answer your question. When you look at the alien mantis being, and when you look at the little grays and their doctor types, the Navajos call them the ant people, and that's probably an accurate term. Then you see Bigfoot, which looks like a simian, and he is. And when you look at the reptile creature and you see it's a reptile, my point is, in four or five of those different, in the human version, the so-called Nordic, what do you think the chances are of you finding all five of that DNA somewhere in the universe out there on another planet? Well, I'll give you a big hint. None. So where did they get the DNA? They got it from here. To what end? Well, to create a model to interface with us as human beings And in my view, I think we've been hoodwinked, and I mean big time. Second question, are they here to help us fix the ozone hole or do good things or bad things or whatever? First of all, the alien overall, and I honestly don't think we've ever seen an alien from another planet. I honestly don't think anyone's ever seen one. If I actually see a quote-unquote alien from another world, not these transgenics that we've been looking at, I think we'd probably like them, and they'd probably look at us pretty carefully and probably like us, too. They probably wouldn't be anything like us, and they wouldn't look like us. But the point is that I don't think we've ever seen one. I think what we're seeing is something to interact with us, and is part of a ruse, part of a game, that someone bigger than them has been doing for some time, and this has been going on for a long time. And third part of that question, are the aliens, the models that are presented to us, or if you want to use the term alien, which is fine with me, do they like us, not like us, or whatever? They really don't care one way or the other. They're interested in one thing, and that's survival of their own personal lives. That's why they have this tremendous fear, and when they transfer it to you, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. They've never felt anything like it. They live in that fear in their society, in their hive, so to speak. Last, and this goes to they're not neither moral or immoral. They're neither one of those. They're amoral. They're there to do a job, and they will do that to the best of their ability, or they simply will no longer exist. They will be terminated. They're just like toasters. I mean, you can unplug them and make 1,000 more of them just like them. So they're very careful about making sure they do their jobs very well. And in closing with that statement, in the rarest cases I know, and believe me, I am no lovers of these kidnappers, these beings of light who operate in darkness, if some people call them, if that's knowing that, I have never seen these entities do anything other than what their makers tell them to do, and if it's to cause you to feel enormous love or whatever, they'll cause you to do that with great zeal. If they're instructed to mutilate you, and we have a brand new case out of Brazil where an elderly lady was mutilated, they'll do that with equal enthusiasm. It means nothing to them. You are absolutely nothing to them in that regard. And in fairness, we have, in the rarest cases, found several rare cases where an alien entity, and I don't mean a gray or anything like that because they just don't have the IQ to do it, but a reptile, of all things, actually helped some of our abductees. This was not a good cop, bad cop thing. We see that all the time. This was not that type of circumstance. So there is a fifth column. I don't know how big it is, but I think that it is real, and I think they're interested in, I think they've even made certain evidence available to me.
Very intriguing, Daryl. You know, you relate particularly in your second book on implants, the need for the alien controllers or handlers to utilize the emotional aspect of the abductions, the fear, suffering, concern of the abductees during these experiences. How can one overcome that fear? How can an experiencer deal with that? I know you're doing a great deal of work with NLP, programming, hypnotic suggestion. Could you go into that, please?
Sure. There's two things we should address here very briefly. Number one is visible implants. By that I mean physical implants that are objects that can be x-rayed or looked at, felt, touched, and this sort of thing. We have in rare cases, in the rarest case we have right now, it's right on our website, Operation Alien DNA and Alien Hunter .org, either one of those will take you to it. But there's a case there where a lady's playing with an implant inside her arm in Brazil, and it cannot be x-rayed, neither can it be show up on an MRI. But those are visible implants, and we feel like that those often can moderate behavior of an individual, and many of these abductees report or state that the serotonin or dopamine, potassium, and norepinephrine, things like this are altered in their case. If that is the case, certainly that would show a great deal of control by the the ones who were hosting these implants and the, some of the injections that they may be doing. Second is we also have another aspect of implants, which is different than, and it's the second book we're writing on implants currently, and it's called The Invisible Implants. Now, a lot of people feel like they need to get an X-ray and find out if they've got a physical implant. The physical implants are not nearly, in my opinion, as disabling or destructive as the invisible ones. The invisible ones can basically generically be described as suggestions that are left within the individual, and there are different ways that it's actually done, but I'm making this super simple for brevity of time. But the invisible implants themselves are that aspect of the implant where it's often invisible, and it can be in the form of suggestions or through something that affects the neurotransmitters themselves, either by an injection, but therefore still invisible, and causing a change of behavior or effect on the individual. If an individual chooses to fight, to resist, to be a warrior, if you will, and I don't care whether you're Native American, Indian, Irish, Celtic, or not, you can resist if you choose. And you have to understand that the things they're doing to you in the invisible realm, those are suggestions. The I can't move, I'm paralyzed, those are suggestions. They're powerful suggestions. They've been given to you since you were a child. But the fact is, if you choose to resist them, and we're working right now on some CDs specifically in that realm for the help of individuals in this that want to do this, you can choose to resist, and not only that, you can become a spy. And I love this little hit here for the alien hunter. You can become a spy for the alien hunter, if you will, and start instead of. Crying or wailing over the terrible things that have happened to you in the events, you can actually become a spy in those events and start getting good evidence.
That's very intriguing information, and you know, I can't wait to discuss that. I think it's the 1992 mass abduction events where you were able to derive the experiencers themselves by proactively dealing with the aliens, were able to obtain a great deal of important intelligence on perhaps what the alien mindset is, their concern about some of their activities being monitored by yourself and Saber Team. You know, when I read your implant book, I found it really quite daunting. The information is actually rather haunting. The second book on implants contains quite a listing of implanted and embedded object types. The visible alien implants, which you mention, that could include that your modalities to make suggestions via neurotransmitters or action potential processes, which you described here, and mental and suggestive programming by the alien. Also, you know, and this particular next topic is referenced in the first book on implants. The biologic, quote, this is from the second, the title is from the second book, quote, biologically engineered cocoon implants / embedded objects, end quote, with the use of keratin for concealment of the object from the human body. Are those the ones with that second brain aspect?
No, those are designed specifically for the body not to find or detect it, nor to give off any hint that through an inflammatory process, either chronic or acute, that there is in fact a foreign body in a person. This is beautifully done by this keratinous material that is placed and attached to nerve tissue so that it in effect can do whatever it's supposed to do, whatever that may be, in the individual. And I want to make this very clear because I'm not one of these people that goes out there and likes to scare abductees or give them no hope or anything else. Everybody's got an implant. That's just not true. I look at hundreds of x-rays every year, and I find almost no implants in anyone. They are extremely rare, and people going out and telling everybody they've got implants, they're just doing it for either to make money off of them or scare them. and ask somebody that knows, and that'd be me, since I discovered it in 1960 in my own event. But the one you speak of, let me back up just a little bit. I spoke 250 surgeons at the John Muir Medical Hospital on medical complications of alleged human-alien contact, specifically implants. Now, these 250 surgeons were not there. They were there for continuing education, but they were not. They were shocked with the subject matter. And after a while, three of them came on board to work with us. This was a great boon to us. But the thing I told them is, we had not done any actual public surgeries at that time, and we were going to that coming year, and we did in 1995. Did three more the next year. The point is that I told them that these objects that we're seeing, these physical objects we're seeing in these people, are old, probably 30, 40 years old. They're passe. They've been around forever. And what we need to be looking at are lumps inside these people that will not show any kind of metal or any other kind of object, that in fact the nerve cells that tested will, in my opinion, probably be central nervous system cells, in other words, a mini brain wherever it's located in the body.
And can I ask you a question on that? I do note from your second book, and thank you for clarifying that for me, Daryl. I note in your second book the term, quote, mini brain center, parentheses, incubation of central nervous system cells, parentheses, end quote. Now, is that the type of implant that affects the endorphin level, or is that something else? Could you just explain that for me? I appreciate it.
That type of implant, we think we may have found one, and it was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
Disappeared under the care of my former partner, mm-hmm. and no wonder he got busted by the State Podiatry Board. But anyway, we only surmised this the two doctors told me after the first surgery and said, how in God's name could you know that there would be no signs of inflammatory response, chronic or acute, and know that the wrong nerve cells would be present and something you've never opened anybody up to see? And I said, well, I've already been there and I got my t-shirt, so to speak, so I kind of know a good deal more about the alien than you may think. And anyway, I was right, and the point B is not that I had to be right, but the fact I was right, and it was, and it's simply because I've already been there. I've already been through those experiences, and sometimes you overhear what the alien's actually thinking. And once you get tired of being afraid, and you get tired of accepting their suggestions, there are techniques that I've already developed where you can literally listen in and hear what they're saying. You'd be amazed the conversations you can get into, and some of the information you can come back with if you get past the fear stage or get past the alien Stockholm syndrome, where you think they're here to save the planet or fix those on hold or keep you in the school of higher consciousness or whatever it is you think you're doing.
That sounds very intriguing, Daryl. We'll definitely return to that subject. At this point, we're about to take a 10-minute break. During our break, I'd like to recommend to the audience Daryl Sims' website at www.alienhunter.org. We will be back directly. And thank you, Daryl. I've already learned a great deal and can't wait to continue this discussion in about 10 minutes' time. Thank you.
The Church of Mabus radio show is now in session, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern, with High Strange Scholars teaching us of ufology, the paranormal, and the occult, and the metaphysical. Seek sanctuary with the Dark Reverends, Jeffrey Pritchard and Guy Widell, at www.mabusincarnate.com, always moshing with the apocalypse. Now get down on your knees and pray!
Are you a fan of the unknown?
Do you constantly watch the skies, wondering if there's something out there?
In fear of things going bump in the night?
Pittsburgh Radio brings you headfirst into the world of the paranormal with the latest news and interviews with the paranormal elite.
With hosts Jordan Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed in the world of ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Whispers Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514.
Session with Daryl Sims, the alien hunter. Daryl Sims, an international researcher, is a certified master hypnotherapist, master NLP practitioner, and board-certified hypnotic anesthesiologist. Daryl Sims has authored, with Patricia Gray, two books on the alien implant topic. First, Alien Hunter, The Evidence in Light, and the second book, Alien Hunter, Evidence and Truth About Alien Implants. Welcome back, everyone, to a fascinating discussion with Daryl Sims, the alien hunter. Now, I'd also like to reference to the audience tonight as well that host Joe Montaldo of UFO Undercover will be doing a rare pre-record of his interview with Jim Sparks. Tonight, it's going to be taped from midnight to 2 a.m. It's actually going to be broadcast live tonight from midnight to 2 a.m. Central Time. You don't want to miss it. Jim Sparks, author of The Keepers. It should be a fascinating discussion. Again, UFO Undercover this evening, Friday, from 12 midnight, well, going to Saturday morning, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. Central Time. Joe Montaldo interviews Jim Sparks for his program, for Joe Montaldo's program, UFO Undercover. You don't want to miss this latest in a really fascinating series of contactee interviews. Now, oh, thanks so much so you can hear me. I'll speak right up. Thank you so much, VZE. Okay, Daryl. Well, now, Daryl, there's one definition that I wanted to just ask further clarification on, and that would be the use of your term transgenics. Does that have a special significance here as far as the alien term or source?
It does have a special meaning, and it's a term that's been used by Bud Hopkins and myself and Dr. Jacobs to sometimes they use it to describe the Nordic, but I think the broader sense in which I use it is that, in fact, the and I used this made the statement previously that I don't think we've ever actually seen an alien. If aliens exist out there, if you can get past the Drake equation and all that, if they exist, I don't think they're going to be interested in kidnapping us and doing all kinds of bizarre things, sticking needles in our eyes and foreheads and different locations where they have, and doing some pretty horrific things to us, all in the name of and then lie to us and say that we were chosen special, unique, or scare us half to death, and care not whether how it affects our lives or anything else. I just don't think that a true quote-unquote alien from another world is going to be interested in doing that sort of thing. I think that's unique and systemic to this program. We refer to the in-house, we refer to the alien implants and programs that they run as alien adware or alien malware, like these computer programs. And some of this stuff is pretty mal when it comes to affecting us and adware, things that we never intended to have, certain phobias and fears of going certain places and doing certain things, obsessive compulsive behaviors, even physical maladies such as xerophthalmia, which is a side effect of our abduction experiences, where we've been subjected to some very brilliant lights and things like this, and it affects your eye cones to the point that your eyes become, you end up with night blindness, basically. And there are just all kinds of little side effects that crop up in with abductees, up to 31% of them having rare drug allergies and so on. These are pretty bizarre things, and some of us even having effects likened to Asperger's and so on. Those are pretty horrific things when you think about it. And the question is, why would these guys do that? And And I don't think the quote-unquote ones we refer to as the alien, I don't think he is, in fact, the one responsible. I think whoever made, manufactured, hatched, or cloned him is the problem. He's the one that created the transgenics, or the so-called gray, or the doctor type, or the Bigfoot, the mantis, or the so-called Nordic, and there are other besides the blonde-haired ones that are red-haired, black-haired, and brown-haired entities as well that are human-like. In fact, the ones most noted in history were called the Sasistas by the Native Americans here in the United States before the white men ever showed up. They knew all about the white-skinned, red-haired Sasistas that were already here. The ones they had seen, and I suspect that those may have been alien as well. But again, they're transgenics. They're simply constructed. Let me back up just a little bit. In my first event when I was a little boy, the first thing I noticed about the guy when I thought about him and he turned around hearing me thinking, the first thing I noticed that he didn't have any clothes on. And when little kids look at somebody without clothes on, what's the first thing they generally notice? Whether you have a TT or not. And he didn't have one. I couldn't understand it. Why didn't he have a TT? Why didn't he have a belly button? Why didn't he have any of these mammary glands, these little things that we have? I couldn't figure this out. And after 40 years of investigating, it took me a little while to figure it out, but the reason he doesn't have genitalia is because he doesn't reproduce. The reason he doesn't have a belly button or a navel is because he didn't get here the same way you and I did. It's easier to think of him as a manufactured toaster or something that's hatched, cloned, or manufactured than it is to think of him as being born, because he wasn't.
Boy, that's intriguing. You know, Daryl, you do reference in the second book the fact that you believe these aliens actually are the constructs of their makers. And in a book, you have several coming out now. Your last book will be written this coming year. You'll be entitling it Hierarchy. And this hierarchy volume will further detail the real alien hierarchies as to the aliens and their masters, their human interaction, details, and purpose. And that sounds very, very intriguing. Now, I don't want to forget an interesting question that has come into the chat room on Paranormal Radio Network from Skymon. And he's wondering, Daryl, if you have seen the Turkey UFO footage from 2009 that could possibly show the occupants, which clearly look like graves, in which Dr. Lear and 12 other witnesses saw hovering over the ocean. Now, Daryl, I think I've seen this YouTube as well, this YouTube video as well. It was intriguing. What do you think?
Well, from the people I've talked to who happen to be scientists in the field, they think it's bogus and that it was that it is in fact a fraudulent piece of film. I have only seen it, taken a cursory look at it, but having seen and known personally, having it been told to me personally, some of the things that Roger Lear has done in the UFO field that was not truthful. Some of them he told me himself. I don't have any confidence in anything that he would say. I would be more interested in the other witnesses than him because simply because of things I know that he's pulled in the UFO field, even on the radio, that simply was not truthful. But the people that I have talked to, and I will go into this in depth, I will have that film footage looked at further from by some of our people on our own team and others related to us and get their full opinion of it. But the ones that I've talked to so far think that it's bogus, and I will tell you this, quite a few things come out of Turkey every two or three years, and they end up debunked, and this is real not uncommon for things to come out of Turkey and them for them not to be for the claim to be that it's whatever it is, alien and so on and so on, but when the pedal meets the metal, so to speak, the facts don't match the data. But we'll keep a close eye on it. We will look at it very carefully. I'll send it out to several the DSP satellite specialists and others who are extremely skilled in this field, and they'll give us a very clear opinion. But so far what I've gotten from it is that it in fact is not credible.
Daryl, thank you so much for that answer. Your response is very much appreciated by me, Skymon, and the audience. Thank you. Now, you know, Daryl, one thing that particularly impresses me about your work as well is your emphasis on forensics, and I'll emphasize here your description or what I am inferring from that, that forensics entails the collection of impartial evidence through use of scientific and medical techniques and principles. Of course, that's a legal concept as well, a legal construct as well. That's very much accepted. Now, Daryl, you are a stickler for following forensic protocol and procedure to obtain the most accurate and objective results. And, you know, my favorite example of possible visible evidence that has followed a forensic protocol is that was provided by the case where the window, the mid portion of a window in a gym, I'm trying to think if it's Houston, I'm not sure, I believe it was in Texas at least, in a gym owned by a policeman, bore the imprint of a hand that many believe is alien. Could you give more details on this?
Most certainly. The case comes to me from a police officer, a buddy of mine, who's also an abductee, and his response was that I need to get over there as quick as possible. It was in Fleetwood, Texas. He had a workout, a gym, and a health spa that he ran, and when I got over there, I said, and it was raining, and it was a little damp outside, and I said, why have you got this window covered up with black paper, and the others are so nice? And he said, it scares people. And when everyone was gone, he takes the paper down, and from the steamy outside and the cool inside, it's actually two hands and a little arm, 32 inches off the ground, show very clearly in the glass as almost a hologram. And I'm floored looking at it, and he says it scares people. And he recounted an abduction encounter where they came up through that glass, and he said, but I don't understand why that would leave an image in the glass. And my first response was, generally behind some of these events, there's a very bright craft or a very bright light that appears when they manifest in three dimensions. And I said, sometimes in the event of actual human events, you can be standing next to a window, as an example, and lightning can strike very closely to you. When it does, it'll often photograph the image of your face in a faint way into the glass itself, and it will remain visible sometimes for a few days. This may, in fact, have been what happened with the entity as he went through the glass coming into the building. We have had some specialists take the glass and examine it in great degree, obviously apart from us, without any input from us whatsoever. And their discussion is that the image is not due to any kind of manufactured error or any other problem associated with manufacturing. That in fact the image appears to be on the glass, in the glass, and they have no explanation for why two little hands, and both of the hands seem to be gnarled and even deformed, and a little arm attached to one of them as well. And one scientist has come forward at a university, a professor, and said he could interface that glass with an interferometer. And he said that test would cost about $12,000. And he said he, if successful, he could pull out a three-dimensional image of what went through the glass. That's pretty exciting, but I just don't have $12,000 on hand.
Yes, that's a very intriguing case, and of course those research results would be very interesting as well. Very well done. To me, it's a very powerful case, particularly as well, not only the evidence itself, which is very striking, but the fact that the principal is a policeman. Someone whose word is very much honored, and it's one intriguing case. Now, you know, Daryl, you mentioned in your second work the importance of such cases as that of Patricia and also Pat Parinello. Here there's that theme that the aliens don't wish to have their implants removed. You mentioned in the Patricia case, I think her name's the pseudonym, that she had found an implant in her foot, or rather it was shown through X-ray. A similar T-shaped object was found in the foot of Patricia's mother. And Patricia and family share different abduction events or have had similar abduction, no, similar, actually share different abduction events. And with this case of Patricia and her family, you can juxtapose that of Pat, also a Texan, and he believes he received his implant at age 6 in the back of his left hand. Later in life, he did have it X-rayed. But now, the two individuals, Patricia and Pat, not related, did feel pain in the respective areas of those implants when they were both considering, respectively, the removal of their implant.
That is most correct. They both approached me. Patricia approached me and showed me quite clearly from her doctor's reports and from him that, in fact, these were surgically installed, three objects. He thought it was from an osteotomy, and she had never had previous surgery, and he knew that, which startled him. The second thing is in Pat's case, he, as you correctly recounted, had a memory, and I assure you it's a screen memory. Of how that object got in his hand. He claimed that a basketball-sized object came down and landed in the field where his, and of course, now what the question is, what are you doing out in the middle of the field in the middle of the night looking at a basketball-sized sphere spinning in some incredible, remarkable way, and then all of a sudden you realize something's wrong with this picture. You take off running and it explodes and it blows the object into your hand. Well, the reason we know that story is not completely true, only part of it is because the object, if it had blown into his hand, it would have been, had an inflammatory process associated with it and a scar. There is no scar. There's no point of entry. And, in fact, the object turns out to be a rare meteorite from the Yaochung, or the Wittbadstätten structure meteorite. This was studied by New Mexico Tech and Los Alamos Labs in a $22,000 study, in which they determined this, these objects to in fact be extraterrestrial. So we, again, this goes back to the story that this was a screen memory that was left of this guy because they didn't want him to know what really truly happened. And in the case of Patricia, she had three objects in her foot, a T-shaped object and another one off to the side. Later, her mother, who did not believe a word of this stuff, her cardiovascular surgeon, when she was in surgery for heart surgery, did a full body scan on her and asked what would this metal clip doing in her foot. And of course, the mother was horrified because number one, she doesn't believe in this stuff. And number two, what we found in her daughter is now in the mommy.
Oh, that definitely is very thought-provoking in a negative sense. Now, two questions coming in here, Daryl. I mean, the similarity in the implants in the mother and the daughter. And, of course, those were installed without the informed consent of either the mother or the daughter. We have an interesting question coming in here from an Esther. She's wondering, Daryl, if E.T. has ever removed implants themselves. My dovetail question to that would be, perhaps they remove them for analysis of data and perhaps to reinsert a different type or another E.T. Implant?
Very good questions, excellent questions, and I'm happy to answer them. The number one is that they install them to begin with, and number two, they do take them out from time to time, and in my case, 1960, at age 12, on 1305 Ohio Street in Alamogordo, New Mexico, I was woke out of a fitful sleep. I heard my mother calling, which didn't make any sense because she's in the far bedroom with my dad in another, you got to go clean through the entire house in our entire little back bedroom for me to hear, and I hear her as clear as a bell, like she's in the same room. Well, I got news for you. That's a screensaver. That's not my mommy. It's her mimic of her voice. And she says, Daryl, go outside and look if there's a new star in the Pentine. Well, there is no Pentine, but I knew exactly what she was talking about. And I assure you it was not my mother talking. So I go outside. It's wintertime again. It's very cold, and I'm in my little pajamas. And 12 years old, walk outside, and I notice the most brilliant star I've ever seen. There's Venus. There's, you know, all the other stars every night, like there always is. And there's a extremely bright one, like in the movie, hate to use this illustration, but it's true. It's like in the movie, what's the name of that movie? The guy's walking along, and a star comes out of the sky, it's bright light, and knocks him down. He wakes up on the street like that. It was a very brilliant, John Travolta phenomenon, the movie phenomenon. It's very similar to that. And this is 1960, and the light is not up way up in the sky. It's toward the horizon. It comes very, I notice it getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and I can't figure out what that is. Of course, I don't realize it's coming toward me. The next thing I know, I wake up inside a circular room, with my feet elevated 11 degrees, and this brilliant bright light over me, and there's the same cosmic skinhead that's been picking me up all along. I recognize him out of a million of them. They all look the same, but I don't know why I can tell him apart. And there's somebody bigger than him in charge, and I can overhear them talking. And I literally started crying because I knew what it was they were saying, and I knew what they were going to do. And what the impact is going to do to me, what their intent was. And I finally put that in my other book. But they intended to alter and shut down certain parts of my left hemisphere. And what's really weird is they use that term. The term left and right hemispheres and left and right hemispheric specialization isn't even in the literature until the 50s, 50, 55, 56. About Dr. Roger Sperry and his work. So the bottom line is, they do take them out as they mine in. Later, I don't know when, out of one of the 10 events that they came and got me, they came and took the implant out later. Some implants are expelled because of the nature. They're only left in the nasal passage, and they're not completely secured. They're there to allow a certain type of medicine, or I want to use that. I'm being very, very kind here, medicine. Whatever it is they've attached to it to dissipate into your system, and then they would be expelled naturally, and you probably wouldn't even know they were there. We've had 8 little gold spheres in a little girl's nose on 2 different occasions as an example, looked at by the York University metallurgist. So the implants can be removed. They can be taken out. They have been. And in my opinion, in one case where we had one of them removed by a podiatrist in back east, and had nothing to do with Roger Lear, this was a guy that had not gotten in trouble with law or any medical group or anything like that. He took the implant out of the guy's foot, and by the next day, did another X-ray and found it back in there.
Boy, that's very intriguing. Now, you know, Daryl, to me, not only is that an interesting clarification of the different type of possibilities with implants, removal and reinsertion, etc., but, you know, you beautifully countered what happened to you with your procedures. You utilized your innate abilities to counteract any type of agenda or purpose that the aliens had in mind for you, and that's really a tremendous accomplishment. Now, several additional questions here. Oh, lest I forget, Norris Boy, one of our key researchers, had a fascinating question in text. Norris Boy's question is, Daryl, did ET work with Native Americans, for example, the Ohio Hopewell culture, about 2,000 years ago, but began abducting Native Americans when they became more warlike during the Fort Ancient culture about 1,000 years ago? Do you, Daryl, have a comment? And thanks, Norris Boy.
The all I can say concerning the Native cultures is this. I've been told by some of my New Age friends that the reason they chose the Irish, the Celtic, and the Native Americans is because they were so spiritual. And I said, now, wait a minute. I said, if you're not black, you can't talk about blacks. If you're not Hispanic, you can't talk about Hispanics. If you're not Native American, you better not talk about Native Americans. If you're not Irish, you better not talk about the Irish. Well, I'm Native American, Irish, both, so I can talk about both of them. And the bottom line, as far as I am concerned, is that if you tamper with or get into Native American territory, such as their land, as an example, like Lakota land in the 1850s, you're looking for a good haircut. You ought not be there. They didn't invite you, and they don't want you there, and you need to get out of the area immediately, or you're going to get a good close haircut, or worse. And the same thing with the Irish when they came here, and they intermarried many of them with the Cherokee, or the Anuyunwiya is a real name. That's what we're really called, or enemies call us the Cherokee. It means the people who speak a different speech because we're not really not from the South. We're from the North. We're actually Algonquin stock. Anyway, the fact is that the alien, in my opinion, has tried to. And this is an uninformed opinion here I'm giving. I can't say this with all authority that it's this or it's that, but it's my thinking that they have consistently tried to make honeybees out of these killer bees. In other words, to render our will ineffective and simply allow them to do what it is they do and what they are supposed to do according to whoever runs their show. In my opinion, they have tampered with Native cultures a long time. Some of them you could consider, such as the Hopi as an example. They may have helped in the sense of the word that they had an interest in providing them with certain kinds of information. Again, this to me goes back to good cop, bad cop, and it doesn't make any sense to get rid of your lab rat, so to speak. So. And some people say, oh, I was healed by the alien. Well, and well, me too in the sense of the word. I have broken ribs on one side after my last violent event at age 17, and I was healed up overnight. But no one ever asked the right question. Not did the alien heal you. The question is, why did he break my ribs apart to begin with? And I'm not the only one.
Very well said. You know, Daryl, I've always found intriguing your comparison to the alien network as operating as though it were an intelligence network in the gathering of intelligence. Now, of course, you and Saber Team are intelligence gatherers, collecting and analyzing the quantifiable input or data. And, of course, you have a wonderful background in intelligence, military. You did have a very high clearance. And, you know, Daryl, lastly, I'm sure this is a rambling question. I apologize. That mass abduction event of 1992, I think it was 1992, two events that month, described in your two implant volumes, details the counterintelligence attempt of the alien, which went very wrong after the abductees were prepared in advance to be proactive.
Yeah, we... To inform the audience a little bit, just a tiny bit about my background, I worked in Central Intelligence Agency for 2 years in covert operations. I was not a spy. They asked me if I wanted to come back into the agency and be a spy, and I told them no. We did not leave on good terms. Ended up bringing a case against them that went to Congress, as a matter of fact, on a First Amendment issue. But so I'm not part of the family anymore. And that's the term they use whenever you're in. And I'm not family anymore. So anyone thinking that I'm part of the collective intelligence community anymore, that's a negative. But the fact is that I do have an intelligence background. I do have a top secret clearance, did have a top secret clearance. In other words, that meant the government trusted me with a great deal of information and information that... would otherwise not be trusted to a lot of people. And I have different hats that I wear. I have a medical hat, a scientific hat, those two together, a cop hat, and my PI hat, which I refer to them together, and an intelligence hat, which is my intelligence background, and an abductee hat, and I'm an abductee, and I admit it, and I don't have a problem with that. And I also have a spirituality hat, which allows me to look at things from a spiritual point of view, and, of course, a Native American hat. And that's all those hats are important, and I say all this in answer to your question In a mass abduction, as I started looking at the alien after they took my son, it started the wheels processing. And this is, I think, significant for me to tell your audience, and because it's, you'll find it very true with many, many, many of the abductees and contactees. Out of my 10 events for 13 years, I never, ever put together that any of these events were connected. That's called programming. That has to do with the invisible implants. And that's just amazing to me that you can have such traumatic events like that and never even make a connection between any of them. Like they're all separate events, yet each time they happen, I would know the players, so to speak. But I would never, ever link it back to other events. I mean, this is unbelievably effective programming. And it took me years to figure this out. And when I first started looking at this after they got my son, I realized, oh my gosh, these guys were operating just like we did in the intelligence community. They lied, they prevaricated, they obscured evidence, they did everything they could. I mean, they did just what we did in the intelligence community. We lied and we covered things up, and you have to if you're in the intelligence community, otherwise your stuff's going to get caught or found out, and then somebody finds that out, they can obviously do something about it. Well, the same's true of the alien. And so I decided to do an experiment. And then I got a volunteer, and she was a contactee, likes the alien. I mean, they like her real well. Half time, they don't even paralyze her or anything. She's so harmless. She's like a honeybee that doesn't have a stinger or something. I mean, she's just so kind and gentle and fun lady to be around. And I asked her if she would volunteer for this, and she said yes, because you've never charged us a penny. You've always helped us, and blah, 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 all these wonderful accolades. And I said, good. And she said, I'll volunteer for anything. I said, well, I'm going to induce amnesia, and I'm going to install a memory in you from another abductee who I think has intelligence information on them and doesn't even know it. That's one of the reasons people get blocks in their events, because they've seen or heard something the alien knows they should have never, ever heard, and that's what happened here. So I installed a memory in the lady. Long story short, a month later, she gets picked up in a regular abduction. She blurts out all this information, and, of course, the alien realizes, because he uploads and downloads from you all the time as an abductee or contactee. He knows what's in your brain. All of a sudden, she blurts out intelligence information about them no one's supposed to even know. And the question is, how does she know that? Because she couldn't know it. Well, they picked up this lady, my senior investigator, and six other people in two states and several cities in a mass abduction, and they took them all in small craft to a craft that was approximately 50 miles thick and 600 miles across. Before somebody thinks I've been smoking something, and I've never done drugs my entire life, nor do I even physically smoke anything. I didn't even believe my senior investigator when he told me about the size of this craft. And then he showed me an independent film that had been shot during the time of the mass abduction that no one even knew. It was shot actually in Japan toward the moon, and we think we may have got the craft on our own film. The craft was massive. And the question that one has to, it just begs the question. If you have a planet somewhere, what do you need a craft 50 miles thick, 600 miles across? Known that, we've seen several other NASA film footages that show craft several thousand miles long, and they're all in the neighborhood out here in our solar system. And the question is, again, what do you need those massive craft for? And in my opinion, what you're looking at there is the alien Dr. Moreau up there in his genetic lab doing his job. And you wonder where all the sperm and eggs are going that are taken from abductees and contactees everywhere? Actually, the place. And that this whole thing is an intelligence operation. I'm telling you, if you put your intelligence hat on and take off your UFO hat and kind of lay it aside for a minute, and you can think and have the skills to use your intelligence hat, I guarantee you this stuff will make a lot of sense to you.
That sounds very reasonable to me, Daryl. Those are very powerful arguments there. Now, Daryl, on the subject of MIBs, I'm thinking here of the transgenic concept. Daryl, do you believe that initially there were military and government MIBs, but that now the MIB phenomenon relates more to aliens or, as you describe them, transgenics, or at least some of them as transgenics? I think you referenced this in your second book.
Yes, I agree that both those concepts were true. The United States government was using men in dark suits and things like this to intimidate people in black sedans long ago, to intimidate people and get information. They would call themselves government agents and so on. Back then, you didn't have to give anybody any ID. My God, if somebody looked at you and said, I'm an FBI or government agent, oh my gosh, you'd nearly pass out and think, oh my God, what did I do? You know, you can hardly, you don't even know what to do. You know, you're almost like people even today who get a brown envelope in the mail and it says IRS in the corner. You wonder, oh my God, what have I done wrong? And you're so scared of me, you just can't even stand it. You know, you need to be, your government needs to be afraid of you, not you, your government, according to Thomas Jefferson. And it's just good advice. And these guys showed up in a long time ago, and they, a lot of them were government people. And an office of Air Force Office of Investigations, my view with majority of them. But unbeknownst to, and you correctly bring out, is that there is a MIB aspect to this, which part is part and parcel to the alien. Anytime you see a MIB show up, in most cases, he's there to fix a problem that cannot be resolved by the little gray or the doctor type. He's there to correct the issue, and he's very effective at doing it. We had two of them show up in my house with my daughter-in-law, who's an abductee, who fled Brazil to get away from this stuff. And two of them were actually in my home and removed a very bizarre and interesting, the strangest implant I've ever even heard of. And they did it out of her, removed it out of her ear because they did not want me to know that it was there, and they thought I was going to find it. But they did that in my home while I was not present.
Very intriguing and horrifying, actually, definitely in that sense.
It was.
Well, you know, Daryl, you, though, are acting very proactively, you and your Saber team. You do have various team specialties, such as the Alien Hunter Trap Team to research the best way to film the alien at close-up range. There have been several projects with that. Also, the Alien Hunter Nexus Team to deal with a special situation. And these individuals come from many disciplines, many areas of expertise.
They do for a fact, and we've recently gotten, and I don't mind saying this because this is part of the research, and I don't care whether we win or whether we lose, whether we fail or whatever, our information is, it's just that, our information is private, but it's not secret, so to speak. In other words, certain things we have to keep private for protection of individuals or for other reasons, but it's not secret. Because I believe most of this information belongs out in the public and people should know it. And one of the type things that I think people should know is that we've had two DNA specialists come on board and almost as quickly disappear from from our conversations about as fast as they got here. They volunteered by listening to radio programs that I've been on before, very intrigued, very amazed, very everything. And when they either see the evidence or get ready to see it, they just all of a sudden don't talk anymore, and they walk away. And fortunately, we have a brand new one. And it's a biologist out of New York City, and it sounds to be going to be very helpful, very effective, and I'm very excited about that. But we've lost two so far.
We have a subject.
Curious.
Well, you know, Daryl, the subject matter can be so very daunting, and it's multi-aspectual, but it really does have very intense emotional aspects as well. You know, Daryl, and to many, this next person evokes strong emotional reactions. Would you like to note here, Daryl, your impression of Dr. Carla Turner, her pioneering work in this field? She was a colleague of yours in the field and a strong advocate against abduction.
Yes, she was. A wonderful lady, a dear friend, one of my abductees, as I affectionately refer her to her as. And I've never put her forms out there or anything. I don't think she would care. but she filled out her form. We have numerous letters back and forth. She and Barbara Bartholik was her mentor, mm-hmm. and a very fine woman, was in fact one of Jacques Vallée's choices for his research many years ago. So a very credible woman. And Candy, as her friends knew her as, Dr. Carla Turner, contacted me, especially when she found out about the mass abduction where I gave a post-it, no, excuse me, where I did a post-it note suggestion and a lady tore the eye cover off of the alien. I mean, she was excited by that. She said, oh my gosh, Daryl, what you need to do is you need to help us with some of these MyLab cases, or these cases where the so-called military comes in and takes these abductees by force down to these underground bases and all this sort of thing. And I said, well, sweetie, I said, as you know, I love you to death. I said, but I'm going to take an issue here with you. I said, you guys, to me, it doesn't mean that your information is correct, but to me, you've not made a case for the military MyLab cases. You just haven't. I said, I'm not saying that it couldn't happen. I'm just saying that, first of all, I'm ex-military, and I would never be involved in abducting American citizens for the purpose, some surreptitious, evil purpose of supporting aliens or whatever. I said, that just is beyond my wildest stretch of imagination. I said, but even if it were true, I said, most of the cases you refer to are usually women in the middle of the night were taken at machine gun point at an M16 with guys in military police uniforms, take them off to, strangely enough, an underground base almost near their house, so to speak. I said, none of that makes any sense to me. I mean, what do they find, a manhole cover they drop down in? And I said, it doesn't make any sense. And I said, she said, well, I want you to think about, you know, showing these people how to do certain defense things and so on, so they can defend themselves. I said, well, let's take your point of view. Let's say I do that. Let's suppose these events are real, and I give this person the ability and train them to do an instantaneous induction on an individual. In other words, they're down in this mind control base underground, and this MP is standing over there taking smoke on his cigarette, got his M16 laying over, turns his back, and all of a sudden she jumps up, automatically goes into her situation, grabs the M16 and pops around in and points it at the guy and says, move and I'll blow your head off. I said, let's suppose that scenario is absolutely true. What do you think your chances of your abductee getting out there alive is? I said, do you see what you've had me do if I do this? Your abductee is probably going to die as a result of what you and I are trying to do to help them out. I said, there are better ways of getting and gathering intelligence and evidence than grabbing an M16 and blowing somebody's brains out or threatening them. I said, at some point, how are they going to get back, you know? If this is some deep underground base, it's not like you're just going to walk out of there, even with an M16. It's not going to happen. She said, yeah, you're right, and I thank you for correcting me on that. I said, I'm not saying, again, your events are not real. I said, what I'm trying to tell you is that these underground bases, if that's where they're being taken, it seems to be located very close, and some of the evidence doesn't make sense. I said, the alien will often mimic military and other people. Nobody in his right mind is going to wear his military uniform in an abduction case that could put him away for 50 years in prison. Not going to happen.
That's a very off point, Derek. Well said. You know, I want to jump in about 2 minutes left. I asked just very briefly. There are free book to the as in that. Yes. Daryl?
Let me say this very quickly because you're on your phone on the service there. You're breaking up very bad. This is not uncommon for our interviews, especially when we start talking about of alien phenomenon and intelligence stuff. So I'll just go ahead and say this, and hopefully your conversation will come back. But I'm hearing only about one out of every three words, and it sounds like something, something like an electronic extension of your voice in some bizarre form. But I've loved being on tonight, and our website is alienhunter.org or operationaliendna.com. And I answer all my emails if you're interested in looking at them, want to write, or looking at our books, or looking at some free video there. You're welcome to look at it, and I love to hear from anybody, and I do answer all my emails.
Well, thank you, Charles.
Again, this is almost amusing. Therese, as you sound like an elongated speech of somebody tampering with a sound system. It's very bizarre. I'm glad this happened at the end of the show instead of the beginning.